Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 268, recorded Monday, October 10th, 2016. Ben Wisner. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Automatic, the small adapter that turns your clunker into a smarter, connected car. For more information on their brand new Automatic Pro adapter, visit automatic.com/twit and enter the limited time offer code TWIT for $20 off the new device. And by Optical Cables by Corning. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the best minds in technology and spend some time talking. I call it Triangulation because it's me, the guest, and you. And if you are able to watch live, we love that. We do the show every Monday morning around 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. You can join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Give us your feedback, your thoughts and questions. You're going to want to definitely listen to this show because we're talking stuff that is very timely. Ben Wisner is our guest. He's director of ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project. He's been at the ACLU for 15 years, adjunct professor of law at the NYU School of Law. But this is where, of course, his claim to fame, principal advisor, legal advisor to Edward Snowden since July of 2013. Ben, hey, thank you so much for spending time with us.
I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I imagine this is a busy and interesting time for you. First, let's talk about Snowden. What is his current status? He's living in Russia.
He has the equivalent in the U.S. of what we call a green card. So he has legal permanent residency there. For his first year, he had a provisional grant of asylum. He now has renewable 3-year legal permanency, legal residency grants, and we don't have any reason to think that that will be withdrawn. But obviously, a lot of my time is spent trying to get him a better option.
He would like to come home. I know his girlfriend has moved to Russia with him.
Sure. I mean, I think that he's made no secret of the fact that he would prefer to be closer to family and in the only country that he's ever been loyal to, and that's ours in the U.S. Having said that, he's not asking for the world's sympathy. He certainly was willing to face a whole lot more suffering than he has. He expected that he would end up in prison, and he's managed to put together a very interesting and productive and fulfilling life from exile using technology.
Yeah, I haven't seen the new Snowden movie, the Oliver Stone movie. What do you think of that? Is it accurate? Is it typically Oliver Stone where it's kind of polemic or?
If someone once said of Oliver Stone, he's the least misunderstood director in Hollywood. I don't know if that's fair. I think I would say that the movie is accurate in two very central respects. There are two big truths at the center of it, and then there's a lot of dramatization around the edges. And those truths are that the U.S. government did, in fact, develop and deploy a global system of mass surveillance without democratic consent, without consulting the public. In fact, after affirmatively lying to the public about what it was doing. And the second is that the person who came forward to reveal this through journalists, Edward Snowden, did so out of sincerity, out of patriotism, out of love of country, and not for any other kind of personal motive. And I think that the movie really nails those two core truths. And obviously, because this is not a documentary, this is meant to entertain as well, there's some license taken with other details.
Now, of course, the Laura Poitras documentary is riveting and highly recommended. I think people should definitely see that before they see the fictionalized version. But that's accurate. That's actually was shot during the events, right?
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
That,
amazing.
That during this week that changed the world, the camera was rolling.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to her for being able to persuade him to allow the cameras to roll, because people get to see who Snowden was during that time of maximum stress. During that week, he fully expected that he would soon be in prison. He thought these might be his last hours in freedom, and he had a limited amount of time to transfer his knowledge and information to these journalists. And yet you see him in this film, very calm, very articulate, able to explain his motivation and his plan as clearly as possible. People who say that the Snowden who speaks around the world right now must be the product of media handlers need to just look at that movie and see who he was before he met any of us. He had never spoken to a lawyer at the time that those scenes were shot.
I'm very dramatically struck by, after watching the movie, by his genuine fear and paranoia and understanding of the far-reaching capabilities of the NSA. You know, at first you watch it, you think, "Oh, this guy's just really paranoid. Could he possibly be legitimately paranoid?" But as these documents have come out, we realize he understood better than anybody the capabilities of the NSA. Jason Bourne movie.
He knew what he could do from his workstation.
Yeah,
and he knew that there was a wide gap between what the rules might prohibit and what the NSA could legitimately control. And so he knew that there were thousands or tens of thousands of people sitting across the intelligence community who had virtually unfettered access to the private lives of anyone in the world. All they needed was a search term, an email address, a phone number. When he said that he could call up the president's emails if he just had an email address, he wasn't saying that the rules allowed that. He was saying that the technology made that capable, and there was no audit system that would have detected that had he done that. And you know, we know that because, after all, he walked out of the NSA with some very, very highly sensitive things, and the NSA still doesn't know what was taken and what was not. They're still making wild guesses about what he took and gave to journalists, and they're waiting for articles to be published to find out.
We haven't seen all the documents yet.
Oh, no. And we never will, probably. It was never his intention that we would see all the documents, or he could have just published them on the internet himself.
Right.
What he wanted to do was put journalism in between his actions and the public. As he says in Citizen 4, he wanted a system that would correct for his own biases. He had spent his entire adult life in the intelligence community. He had very strong views about what he thought was right and wrong, but he wanted to entrust the decision to journalists, their editors, their publishers, in consultation with the government, to make the very hard choices about what the public needed to see in free societies.
That was the thing that most impressed me and convinced me that Snowden was a patriot. That's my personal feeling, was that instead of just dumping it at WikiLeaks, as others have done, a treasure trove of information and let people sift through it, he did what I thought was incredibly responsible, which was to, and not just give it to one newspaper, to give it to several,
right.
Let them vet the contents, you know, and then this is the one thing that's a little difficult for me, and then spin it out slowly. I realize the value of spinning it out slowly is we can look at it individually and it keeps our attention. There may also be this cynical notion that, well, we'll also continue to generate content for years to come, and The Intercept has benefited, Glenn Greenwald has benefited.
I don't think that's what's going on, Leo. I think that in the beginning, there was obviously a strategy not to publish 10 stories every week because the public would not have been able to digest it.
Yeah.
But I think that after a few months, a lot of the low-hanging fruit had already been published. The things in the archive that were, you know, memos or court orders that very clearly explained what the government was doing. And most of it is much, much harder to report on. If you've seen intelligence documents, they're complex technical PowerPoints, that they are diagrams. And so the news organizations have had to hire computer scientists, engineers, technologists to help them just understand what's in this archive and then to make measured judgments about what the public ought to see and what they shouldn't see. So I don't think at this point any news organization is sitting on a story out of any you know, sort of strategy to sell newspapers or extend the length of this debate. I think that if there were easy stories in there, they would have been published a long time ago.
No, and I have been satisfied.
One other thing.
Yeah.
You know, you hear from NSA defenders and Snowden critics that he should not have gone to the press. that he should have gone somewhere within the chain of command. There must have been some channel that he should have gone through in government in order to raise his concerns. And it's a very odd argument, because as President Obama correctly said in June of 2013, the programs that were revealed by journalists from the Snowden archive had been comprehensively approved by all three branches of government. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court had signed off on them. The Senate and House Intelligence Committees had been briefed on them. The president and the NSA director had authorized them. And it was only after the public was brought into the conversation through journalists that all three branches of government actually changed their minds about it. And open federal court started saying these programs are illegal. Congress changed the law for the first time since the 1970s to take away spying power from the NSA. And the president admitted that the programs had gone too far. So what was Snowden supposed to do in May of 2013? Call up the Senate Intelligence Committee and say, I'm a 29-year-old contractor, and I want you to know about programs that you've approved in secret. The problem was that constitutional oversight had failed, and we needed the fourth estate, the media, put into the First Amendment to the Constitution for a reason by the framers to reinvigorate democratic oversight.
Nevertheless, President Obama, I think, continues to consider Snowden a traitor.
I don't know that he would use the word traitor today. I expect he would use much more temperate language. Everyone remembers back in 2013 that he said, we're not going to scramble jets for some 29-year-old hacker. And then the next month, they almost did precisely that. Yeah. The U.S. told European allies to ground the presidential plane of the Bolivian president because of a rumor that Snowden might be on board. But more recently, we've heard different language from the president. He has said that the debate that Snowden helped launch has made the country stronger. No doubt he would have preferred not to deal with it in this way. It certainly has caused diplomatic headaches, and no president wants to allow someone, some individual in the intelligence community to drive the agenda from below, as Snowden did. But I doubt that you would hear that kind of traitor language. And in fact, Eric Holder, the attorney general who first brought charges against Snowden, went further and said that Snowden performed valuable service, a public service, that the debate was a necessary one. I don't think that either of them believes that Snowden should escape all punishment, but I think that their language has changed a lot in the last few years.
Yeah, that's a significant turnaround from Holder. You know, on the other hand, I can understand why you might call for a prosecution, if only to get the complete facts out. Certainly there are those who would like to see and have said they would like to see Snowden lined up in front of a firing squad.
It would be a different story if we had a consistent record in this country of enforcing the law against leakers, including senior government officials. But in fact, there are thousands of leaks of classified information every year, most of them from very, very high up in government, and no one is ever prosecuted for that. And let me add that Washington is crawling with former government officials and current ones who have been pardoned. We just don't use that word.
Right.
When President Obama came to office and said, we're going to look forward and not backwards, and we're not going to criminally investigate the architects of a illegal torture regime, he was granting a prospective pardon to all of those officials in the Bush administration who had brought that kind of shame on the country. And again, that was a political decision. I'm not here to say it was the incorrect one in this conversation, but if you can make that kind of political decision on behalf of senior officials who committed torture or lied to Congress, it doesn't strike me as at all of a stretch to say that someone like Snowden, who actually helped the country to historic reforms, should get the same kind of executive grace.
Yeah. Well, maybe he will.
Maybe he will. We're trying.
Are you? You're actively pursuing a pardon?
We are. In the middle of September, the ACLU was joined by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. So you have the three largest human rights organizations in the world. And we launched a pardon campaign. It has its own URL, pardonsnowden.org. We're trying to gather elite support, but also mass support. And we're trying to collect hundreds of thousands or even millions of signatures from around the world to present to President Obama in January before he leaves office.
Very interesting. One of the questions last night at the debate I thought was interesting. One of the public that was invited into the debate asked specifically Hillary Clinton about a speech she'd given in which she'd said that it's normal and okay in government to have a public face and a private face, not to tell everybody what's going on. And she defended it by saying, well, I had just seen the Lincoln movie and I watched how he manipulated Congress essentially into freeing the slaves.
Well, let's put the best spin on that. I actually think that there is some truth to that. So,
that's why I want to ask you, because the government does have a good reason in some cases, certainly with intelligence, to keep secrets.
Well, not just intelligence. I mean, let's talk about confidential state-to-state diplomacy. It would be very hard to pursue or to assist with peace negotiations in Ireland or in Israel and Palestine if you couldn't have a way to have conversations that didn't appear on the front page of newspapers immediately, because the politics wouldn't allow those conversations to continue. And intelligence as well, obviously, we need to protect the identities of undercover agents. We need to protect the identities of foreign nationals who are cooperating with us, who would be killed if their roles were revealed. I do think, though, that that category tends to expand far beyond reason. And, you know, anyone who has worked in government will tell you that between 50 and 90% of information that ends up classified should not be classified at all. And even if it should be classified, it should be declassified quickly rather than still classified 30, 50, 70 years later, as some of it is. And all too often, the reason for putting that classification stamp on something is not because someone's going to be killed if the public reads a document, but because someone's going to be embarrassed in government.
Well, and it's just the default. I mean, and you see this, by the way, you see it in private business as well. I swim upstream on this. I'm all about transparency, but most businesses, the default is none of your business. But it's more important, of course, in government, it is our business. The government is ours. And so it is our business. And I understand you have to balance.
You do, but I think that the conversation gets flipped around. And so, you know, I find myself being asked all the time, you know, what was the justification for releasing this or for releasing that? And I say, it's really the wrong question. The question is for the government. And the question is, what was the justification for withholding this or that? So the frame is, oh, if you released information about surveillance on American citizens, that's legitimate. But if it's about surveillance on foreign citizens, then it's legal. But why shouldn't we know about it, even if it's legal? We're talking about what our military is doing overseas. So the question, again, shouldn't be, why do we get to see it? But why were they keeping this from us? We should at least have a say in this, unless the disclosure is going to cause demonstrable harm.
I'm looking at an interview, a great interview you did with Ipsita Agarwal in Medium, in which you list some of the things we would not know that the government would like to have kept secret in the last 10 years. And, you know, the torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, I know you've been very active in prosecuting that. Secret prisons that the CIA has set up. The case for war in Iraq based on basically misinformation. The drone program and, of course, Snowden's revelations about the NSA's violation of law and the Constitution. So it's clear. What are the checks and balances, though? You know, I remember talking about the anti-terrorism fight, and I can't remember. I wish I could give him credit. Somebody told me, you know, it all really began when George Bush in 2001 said, this won't happen again. We can't let this happen again. And the National Security Agency and other intelligence agencies took this as carte blanche. Well, if you don't want it to happen again, what you need to do is mass surveillance. Yes, we can handle, we can attempt to keep this from ever happening again, but it's going to require this kind of surveillance that we've embarked upon. What is the current state of checks and balances? Do we have good systems for getting this information out? Things that concern me, the secret courts, for instance, what we're learning about the Yahoo surveillance. Yahoo had fought the NSLs and the national security letters and the secret court rulings for a long time, lost and lost and lost, and finally apparently just threw up their hands and said, fine, we'll surveil our entire user base for you. Are there good checks and balances? Are they being used? Where do we stand?
There are supposed to be, and there are some that are, you know, in our system of government. The irony is that the last great surveillance debate that we had in this country was domestic surveillance debate was back in the 1970s. And that's when the church committee, a bipartisan congressional committee, published the results of a years-long investigation into J. Edgar Hoover, who ran the FBI for 50 years, the NSA, the CIA, the Department of Defense. All of them had been maintaining dossiers on millions of Americans who had no connection to communism or terrorism or anything else. It was a surveillance system run amok. And the structural reforms that came out of that debate were, number one, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Before that, there were no rules at all governing intelligence surveillance as opposed to criminal surveillance. So this created this secret court that at the time was considered better than no court at all. It also created the two committees in Congress, the intelligence committees in the House and in the Senate. 40 years later, in the debate that Snowden helped launch, we see that those reforms from the 70s are the culprits now. And I think that the lesson is that no structure is going to solve this problem for us. You don't get to hack the system and have it be fixed. And it's argument I have with technologists all the time who think that we can come up with a solution to the problem of oversight. There is no solution to the problem of oversight other than aggressive civil society organizations, independent journalists. I mean, think about not just since 9/11, but going back 40 years. What are the most important revelations that we've learned about the intelligence community and its behaviors? Which of those did we learn from court decisions or from congressional hearings? And which of those did we learn from journalists who pried the information out of the executive branch in some way? And the overwhelming majority of that information, of course, came from journalists. And I'm just afraid that we do need legal reforms, but there's never going to be a substitute for independent investigative journalists who know their stuff, who have their sources, and who are able to compete effectively with government over their monopoly over this information.
I think that's really an important message to get out, which is, and you're right, technologists say, oh, we can flip a switch. We have the technology, and right. It's an important message. And this is actually an important message about all of our democracy. This is how it works. It's contentious. It is an advocacy system. We need people like you, Ben, fighting on the one hand to make sure that we go take every step to protect citizens from overreaching intelligence. And at the same time, there is a role for intelligence to play. We do want to be protected. I often bring this up in this debate. I have to say, I feel that the intelligence community are patriots. They are doing what they feel they need to do to protect us. It's not that they're bad people.
I think that's overwhelmingly true. That these are, remember, there's 5 million people in the United States.
I understand that
who
there may be some bad
kind of
actors.
Security clearance. Yes. Yeah. Surely there are bad actors, but this is a debate about policies and oversight and not about individuals. Now, the lack of strong policies and strong laws and strong oversight allows bad individuals to exploit these vast systems. And I've heard people say the problem is not just Big Brother, it's Little Brother. Imagine every local police officer having access to the NSA's database. We know what happens when they have access to surveillance databases. They stalk their ex-girlfriends with it. And we've seen that.
But I think it's a mistake to focus I think it's a mistake to focus on those bad actors and really to talk at a larger general policy level about what we as the people want as oversight and what we demand, what we need.
Although I think that the systems that allow those bad actors to behave in that way allow us to have a conversation about the broader system.
Right.
If you build a comprehensive surveillance time machine, human beings are going to exploit it.
Yeah.
And you need to weigh those harms against the benefits that you think you're going to derive from, collecting billions of needles into a data center haystack. Surely there will be some benefits, but at what cost? And, remember that the Constitution was written by people who were a lot more worried about the government having that kind of power than they were about bad guys getting away. There's really no other way to read the Bill of Rights. So I do think to go back to your point before, the vast majority of people in government are following rules They're behaving conscientiously and honorably in doing that. And I don't in any way blame them for the fact that the rules are grossly inadequate.
The Patriot Act obviously was in, to some degree, a knee-jerk response to a terror action. And
can I actually stop you there?
Because, yes, please.
Because I think it's important to realize that it wasn't. Maybe the vote was knee-jerk, but almost all of the Patriot Act had been written before 9/11 and was on wish lists of government prosecutors. These are the authorities that we want someday. And we need to understand that that's how government works. Again, not evil people, but prosecutors frustrated by barriers. It was difficult for them to share information with spies. There was a wall that made that difficult. And so these were all proposals that had been put forward. And after 9/11, the climate was right for them to dump all of that into a 300-page bill and get it passed before anybody really had a chance to read it or debate it. And we would see the same thing if there's another major catastrophic terrorist attack in this country. And in fact, leaked government emails show that lawyers in the intelligence community are having exactly this conversation. They say, we may be losing the public debate over encryption now, but let's keep our powder dry, because if there is a terrorist attack and we can link it to encryption, maybe we can get the legislation that we need. So I don't think knee-jerk is the right way to describe that kind of opportunistic lawmaking.
Good point. Aren't these people, though, in the National Security Agency and the intelligence agencies, the best people to determine what powers and knowledge they need to do their job?
Absolutely not. Or certainly not as the last word. The idea that we as a country and our system should defer to the expertise of national security officials, to me, is really counter to constitutional principles. Obviously, it's their job to push forward as much as they can and to say, in an ideal world, these are all the authorities that we would want. But it's the job of members of Congress, who are also constitutional officers, to balance that against other principles. And it's the job of federal judges to say, no, that's disproportionate because there are other values than security that are at stake. There's a reason why we don't want our governments run entirely by national security officials, because they have a very, very narrow view, and it may be the appropriate view for their position, but it needs to be tempered and countered by people who are putting forward other values, including the values of liberty.
We're talking to Ben Wisner. He's director of ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project and Legal Counsel. Is that fair to say that you are Edward Snowden's legal counsel or legal advisor?
Oh, it doesn't matter. They're interchangeable. I'm his lawyer. How's that?
You are his lawyer. All right.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. That's fair enough. We'll have more with Ben in just a bit. What a great conversation. You joined the ACLU 1 month before 9/11. So I think we can go back in time a little bit and talk about not just about Edward Snowden, but about some of the other major initiatives that you have started there. But meanwhile, let's take a break. And if you want to take a break, you can do so, too, because I want to talk a little bit about the automatic. I love this thing. Now, you have the right to surveil your own automobile. I just want to emphasize that. And the technology exists for you to do so. In fact, this thing is awesome. The automatic plugs into a little known port at the bottom of right below your steering wheel on almost all cars, every car manufactured in the last 20 years anyway. It's called the OBD2 port, or onboard diagnostic port. I've got my automatic right here. I'll show you. It's just a little Bluetooth dongle that plugs into that OBD2 port. Very easy. There's no installation. You don't need a screwdriver. It just plugs there. You might have seen it and think, that's for the technician at the dealership. He'll plug his machine in there. Well, this is great. This is like you plug your machine in there. You pair it with your phone, iOS or Android, and suddenly you're seeing the kind of information that technician is seeing in a way that you can really use it. I mean, it's as simple as when a check engine light comes on, knowing what that means. And by the way, the automatic is cool because then it'll pull up repair shops near you. But it also tracks your driving. It lets you know if you're driving efficiently, how much that last trip to the mall cost you in gasoline. You keep track of where your car is. You'll always know where you parked. If you have teenagers, this is the best thing ever to put in their car. It's got geofencing. You can keep an eye on where they are. It'll text you when they go outside of the geofenced area. which even when you're not with it, because this new, and this is something new, this new Automatic Pro that just came out has its built-in, its own 3G, which means it's always connected, and you pay no subscription fee for that. You just buy the Automatic. I'm going to give you a special price. It's normally $129.95, but I'll tell you in a little bit how much you can get it for. And you can then use it with, as you can see, all of these apps, like If This Then That, Concur, Expensify. So if you have business mileage you want to keep track of, you could do that fully automatically. You can even link it to like a Nest thermostat. So I'm on my way home, turn up the heat or turn down the AC. You can hook it up to your Amazon Echo, so you can ask the Echo, literally, where'd I park my car or how much gas is left in the car, and it'll know. There's also some significant safety value to this. For instance, the Automatic Pro will detect severe accidents and will call for first responders even if you can't. Awesome, awesome device, not just for you, but for your family. It works with your Apple Watch and Pebble too. I love the Automatic. I have it set up so that when I drive up, the If This Then That says Leo's arrived, things like that. It's just awesome. Now, Automatic Pro is normally, as I said, $129.95, but we have a special deal, $20 off. Use the offer code TWIT at checkout, and you'll get $20 off. This is the greatest. Even if you had the original Automatic, which I did, get the new Automatic Pro. Free 3G means it's monitoring your car even if you're not in it. Crash alert, real-time location, driving apps for your teenagers to help them be better drivers, and a whole lot more. Check it out at the website, automatic.com/twit. Automatic. See, it's okay to surveil yourself. Just not for necessarily for them to surveil you. We're talking to Ben Weisner. He's a Harvard graduate. In fact, I have to tell you the secret, which is that our producer, Karsten, and Ben were freshman year roommates at Harvard, which is awesome. He also studied law at NYU and was a law clerk to Stephen Reinhart at the U.S. Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit. And right now he is and has been at the ACLU for the last 15 years, currently director of the Speech Privacy and Technology Project. That is right up our alley, isn't it? Speech Privacy and Technology. We talk about that almost incessantly on all of our shows because our audience particularly is concerned with privacy implications to the point where, you know, Google comes out with a new phone or this new Google Home or Amazon comes out with the Echo and people are saying, I don't know if I want a microphone in my house. So I think more than the average bear, our audience is very interested in protecting their privacy.
Let's talk about speech for a second, Lee.
Yeah.
I mean, because I think people don't remember that it wasn't inevitable that the internet would be this extraordinary forum for free speech, the greatest one in the history of the world. That in the 90s, when people were just becoming aware of the internet and starting to use it, Congress passed a law called the Communications Decency Act.
Oh, God.
And what that law would have done, if it had fully taken effect, is it would have put in place on the internet the same speech rules that we have on radio and television. Yeah. You would have had the FCC policing the internet with a decency regime. You know, at that time, the members of the Supreme Court, when the ACLU brought a case challenging this, had never seen the internet. And the story goes that they gathered around the computer of one law clerk just to see what websites were. and that ACLU lawsuit and that decision in a case called ACLU versus Reno, in some ways was the Magna Carta for the open internet that we live with today. Now, there are downsides to it, obviously. Anytime there is a freewheeling forum for free speech, people say some ugly things to each other, and everyone who listens to this podcast has experienced that personally or knows someone who has. On the other hand, the cost of trying to regulate it, especially with criminal law, would have been an internet completely unrecognizable to those of us today.
Yeah. As bad as 4chan or Reddit or Twitter can be, I don't think anybody who's paying attention wants the FCC to be able to ban the eight dirty words on the internet. That is not great. And, of course, I'm old enough to remember 1995 when the National Science Foundation said for the first time, okay, commercial speech is also okay on the internet.
Right.
And there's pros and cons to that, but I think in general, a freer internet is good for everybody, and I think we all support that. So thank you. Thank you and the ACLU for I think you're right. I think people don't realize how close that was.
Right.
I do remember the fight. So you 1 month before 2001, you joined the ACLU. I imagine things changed on 9/11. When you first started before 9/11, what did you think your agenda was going to be?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Oddly enough, I was going to focus more than anything else on domestic jail and prison conditions. With a particular focus on the jails in Los Angeles, California, which is still the biggest jail system in the world. I did end up working on a lot of jail and prison conditions, but the prisons were in Guantanamo. There were secret prisons set up by the CIA and other places. So there's some continuity between what I expected and what came to pass. But it never would have occurred to me when I was in law school in the 1990s that I would be litigating torture cases in U.S. courts against U.S. officials and companies. It just seemed like those issues had been resolved in human rights treaties, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in constitutional jurisprudence, and 9/11, and particularly, you know, the Bush-Cheney response to 9/11 domestically really reopened a lot of those issues that we had thought had been settled decades earlier.
You say Bush-Cheney, that's interesting. How important is the president's role in leading in this direction? Isn't Congress in charge of oversight? Isn't it up to Congress to decide what the intelligence community can and cannot do?
You know, in practice, the American presidency has always been one of the most powerful executive institutions in the world. And that strength has expanded enormously after the Second World War with the development of the bureaucratic national security state. Domestically, the president is more constrained by Congress and by courts. Internationally, the president is almost unconstrained. And what happened after 9/11 was by defining the battle against terrorist groups in terms of war rather than in terms of crime, President Bush and Vice President Cheney were able to move for some years this whole debate into the realm where presidents usually get almost a free hand. And it took several years before the Supreme Court, began the hard work of trying to rein them in, saying, you know, even in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, you don't get to create a prison, throw away the key, and tell judges to buzz off. That goes back 800 years to the Magna Carta. You don't get to rewrite that just because you're calling it a war. So in practice, you know, who the president is tremendously important. And obviously I say that to you just a few weeks out from a fairly consequential presidential election that ought to remind people who don't pay close attention to civil liberties what the stakes are here. People may not worry about the NSA because they believe, as you do and I do, that most people who work there are pretty decent people. But what about building that kind of architecture and then handing it over to someone like Donald Trump? Does that make you nervous? It should make you nervous if it doesn't.
You said that the government should not be able to enforce laws perfectly. I thought that was kind of a provocative statement.
Yeah, well, leave aside the should question and ask yourself whether you want the government to enforce laws perfectly. So technology now has, let's use one example. Let's use driving safety laws. We could require every auto manufacturer to require every person to blow into a tube before starting a car every time. Okay, maybe some people think that's a good idea. It would cut down on drunk driving deaths. We could install cameras at every single stop sign and red light and photograph every violator going through and send a ticket. We could use automated enforcement to detect when any car is going over the speed limit and have it send a ticket automatically. That is not a world that most of us would want to live in. A world where computers recorded our minor violations of simple laws like that and punished us automatically. We put in place a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit because we want to give law enforcement the discretion to enforce that appropriately, not because we think that every time someone drives 26, they should get a ticket, even though that rule was put in place by the city council that they elected, by the mayor that they elected. We don't actually want to have our laws enforced perfectly by technology. If they were, we'd be living in a constant surveillance state.
Of course, we wouldn't even have this conversation without technology. I'm sure the founders didn't contemplate that all laws would be enforced perfectly because it would be impossible. But right. Now with technology and the surveillance state we live in, it is conceivable. And so that's a really important conversation to have. And I don't. When I read that, I went, oh, let me think about that. I think that's a very interesting point. Let's get back to the election because there's a clear choice, but I have to say, and I had told you before we began that I don't normally talk about it, but I am a Democrat. I supported President Obama. I've been a little disheartened, particularly, and it's interesting that you mentioned the president's unlimited power, almost unlimited power in foreign policy, in his drone strike policy, his support of kind of a surveillance state, his kind of active secrecy. And it's particularly in secrecy, it's very clear that Secretary Clinton has even to a greater degree that penchant. So no matter who gets elected in November, we are going to still very much need to keep an eye on those who keep an eye on us, I think.
So here's where I have to say or should say that the ACLU is completely nonpartisan. We don't endorse candidates in any way. And I'm speaking here in my professional capacity. I'm not going to state a preference for a candidate. But I do think that all of the issues that we're talking about are not about the president. They're about the presidency.
See, yes, yes.
They're about the presidency. And so I was not one of those people who was, you know, as personally devastated or disappointed by who President Obama became when he assumed that office, because it was what I expected. I know what that office represents, and I know the institutional pressures on that office. I wish that he had made certain different decisions along the way, but I'm much more disappointed in Congress and in the courts for not fulfilling their constitutional obligation to defend other principles in the face of what will always be executive tendencies. So there's no choice in this election that solves any of these problems. I mean, the simplest way to put it is that democracy is not a problem to be solved. It's a battle to be fought all the time. And it's hard to imagine anyone who could come through the U.S. electoral system and make it as far as the presidency who would not be someone who the ACLU would be suing constantly.
And by the way, I want to emphasize, rightly so, it's that checks and balances. We need these. The founders recognized that this was going to be fundamental to a democracy that survives. And the history of the world and the history of republics usually indicates that survival is a very tough thing for a republic. And
yeah, well, we don't know how fragile our democracy
is.
This seems like one of those elections that's putting a lot of things to the test. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in the aftermath, whether, you know, the institutions turn out to be strong or whether, you know, there is long-term damage from the kind of campaign that we've seen over the last year.
Yeah. Yeah, this is going to be a measure of our robustness of the republic.
That's right.
I try to stay heartened. I try to maintain an optimistic point of view. I think I'm
the same way.
It's very impressive what the founders did, and when you get to these, and I think back to 1974 when a president was very nearly impeached. Essentially was told by the leaders of Congress, sir, you must resign or we will kick you out. And we could have been a constitutional crisis and instead an orderly transition of power. And we've done that even in years like the year 2000, where we're quite contentious. And it's always impressed me at our ability to do that and our ability to come together as a nation. And the rules that the founders created seem to have held up quite well, amazingly well.
And in part that's because some of them were very clear and others were intended to be elastic and to be interpreted in their time and place. So there's no two ways to interpret two senators from every state. But there's no reason why we should look at a word like equality and try to figure out in 2016 what they meant in 1789. That word is intended to be contextual in its time and place. And equality obviously means something quite different to us in 2016 than it meant to a bunch of slave-owning oligarchs who didn't want to let women vote. So, I mean, I think that's part of the durability of the document, is that there's a lot of room for every generation to give it meaning without deviating from the original intent.
Yeah. It's so important, and that people understand that being I think sometimes people feel that the ACLU and other organizations that tussle with government are unpatriotic, and I think it's the most patriotic thing you can do. This is the nature of democracy. It is those checks and balances, and I think when Congress abdicates its responsibilities, that's when we get in trouble. We really need strong all three branches need to be strong and oversee all the other branches. You mentioned that the Patriot Act was triggered by the terror after 9/11. And, of course, the San Bernardino massacre seemed to give the FBI free rein to go after Apple to try to get software to decrypt the iPhone. Do you think the intelligence community is waiting for another San Bernardino to once again launch that effort, or have they understood the need for strong encryption?
No, I think the intelligence community is really divided on that question. And this is what's so fascinating about it, is that you see people in the military and the NSA who are doing cyber defense who realize that actually we have more to lose than more to gain in a world where encryption is easily breakable by law enforcement. And then you see people, again, who have tunnel vision. If you're the FBI director and your job is domestic law enforcement, you're going to see encryption as a problem to be solved and not as something that's a benefit. But that legal dispute between the FBI and Apple was completely fascinating. And I really don't believe it would have turned out the same way before Snowden. I think that it would have been resolved quietly. I think Apple would have done the FBI's bidding, like many companies did back then. And I think that what the Snowden revelations did is that it really exposed that there are no U.S. corporations. These are all global corporations. If there's no company that only wants to sell its phones in the United States, they want to sell them in France and Israel and China and even Russia. And if they're going to do that, they can't be seen as an arm of the U.S. security state. And if the U.S. requires them to build a certain capability, they're going to have to make that capability available to China and to make it available to Russia and Uzbekistan as well. So, I think a lot of people were surprised that Apple was able to successfully resist the FBI in that case. And I, for one, was surprised that the public was pretty divided, that even in an emotionally disturbing terrorism case, where the FBI was trying to get into the phone of someone who clearly was a terrorist murderer, the public understood that the debate was not so simple and that there were real principles on both sides.
Yeah, it surprised me too. And it was fascinating. We spent a lot of time talking about it.
It's not over, though. It's not over.
Right.
They will live to fight another day on this. And I think that, look, we saw them in some ways litigating that case the way the ACLU litigates cases, right? It's not a secret that we do strategic litigation, that we try to find plaintiffs that are sympathetic, that we time them, the lawsuits.
I am shocked.
And that goes all the way back to the Scopes monkey trial about evolution, where the ACLU orchestrated that whole case and paid the fees of both sides.
What? Wait a minute. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? That's 1925.
Because they wanted a decision.
Wanted to have that trial.
Yeah.
Which you can see.
Sometimes you want, and that's just what I was saying earlier about Snowden. Sometimes a trial is a very valuable way to get to the facts and to let the facts flow.
That's right.
So people can
It can be. And then other times it can really manipulate through emotion. And so what the FBI did in the San Bernardino case is clearly they wanted this authority much more than they wanted the data in that phone. I think they realized that there was nothing of great value in the phone, but they wanted the ability to go to a court and force companies to open up their phones to them. So they waited for a terrorism case. And a week before this case became public, the FBI recruited a retired judge to be amicus counsel, friend of the court counsel, to the San Bernardino victims' families. so that they could participate in the case. And again, they really wanted to make this about emotion and not reason. And that can be a very, very effective tool in these cases. What's surprising is that it didn't work, because I can tell you that between 2001 and 2013, the government pretty much just had to say terrorism and national security, and the courts would fall into line. I spent my career having important cases thrown out on those grounds.
We're talking to Ben Wisner. He is fighting the good fight. The at the ACLU, in charge of their or director of their technology privacy and free speech project. We're going to take a little break, Ben. Give you a moment. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about some other case, because we focus on Snowden. It's so obvious what we want to talk about, but I want you to talk about, speech privacy and technology. There's a lot of areas, some of the cases you think are important that people should know about the ACLU and you have litigated. Before we do that, though, I want to talk about fiber optics and Corning. And everybody knows the name Corning, right? Corning glass, right? You probably had some Corningware when you were a kid at home. But what they really excel in is fiber optics. They make fiber optic cables, and they are glass technologists. Yeah, I know. You know about Gorilla Glass? Well, imagine the same kind of technologies that protect your screen on your phone being applied to the glass in fiber optic cables. I remember when we first got fiber optic cables in our studio, they were bright orange, and the engineer said, "Whatever you do, Leo, don't touch those, don't bend them, and do not step on them." So this is a fiber optic cable from Corning. They've made some significant improvements. You can not only step on them and touch them, you can tie them in knots, and they will still transmit. And here's the beauty part. This is a USB cable. They make Thunderbolt and USB 3 cables. You might say, but those aren't fiber optic technologies. That's this amazing little dongle at the end of each cable that takes the signal from the USB port or the Thunderbolt port, the copper signal, and turns it into light so that it can be sent over fiber optic. They also receive the light and convert it back into the RF that the cables need. This is remarkable. This is amazing technology, and it means that you can get cables that are lighter, stronger, and can go a heck of a lot farther. Cable runs of 60 meters, that's 200 feet for Thunderbolt, 50 meters, 165 feet for USB 3. Now, why would you want such a long throw? I'll tell you why. In fact, I'll talk about a company called Universal Audio. You may know them. They do high-end audio interfaces. When they test new equipment in their studios, the last thing they want is a spinning, loud hard drive or a Thunderbolt array in the studio. That's going to destroy all of their measurements. So what they can do with these Corning cables, and they love them, is they move all the, they make Thunderbolt audio interfaces. So they move all of the stuff out of the studio, out of this testing room, because they have these long runs of cables. And it works great. Look, it's great for my home, too. I have a Drobo, a Thunderbolt Drobo. Now, I don't, everything else is SSD. I don't want to hear anything. I put it far away from me, and I use the Corning optical cable, the 3. USB 3.0 cables. These are great. Instead of investing in extenders, adapters, cables, balance, turn to optical cables by Corning to get the connection you need. They're lighter, thinner, much more robust and durable, whether you're into high-end video photography, audio production, just plain old computing. It's great for me, too. I want you to go and find out more at opticalcablesbycorning.com. You can find them at all major electronics and professional AV retailers. Apple stores have them, too. Amazon has them, B&H, and more. Optical Cables by Corning. Longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com. to learn more. We thank them so much for their support. We use them, of course, all the time, everywhere. In fact, I have these demo units, and they disappear. We have to go back to Corning and say, "Can you send us some more?" Because everybody wants them. They're just awesome. Our guest, Ben Wisner, is here. He is the director of ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project, legal counsel to Edward Snowden. And Ben, I am so thrilled to have you here. And this is very timely because, of course, we're in the midst not just of a presidential election, but you're going to be electing members of Congress as well, all of you who are watching. You're going to be voting, I hope, on November 8th. And these are issues you really want to consider. I wish, frankly, we could get people who are running for office to talk more about where they stand on these issues. The problem is they're thorny. They're difficult. And so a lot of times they just ignore them. But you know, put their feet to the fire before you vote. You're a voter. Find out where they stand on this. Are they gonna stand up? And if you're running for a member of Congress, do their duty as a check and balance to executive power. Ben, I'm sure every interview you do, everybody talks about Snowden and maybe the San Bernardino case. But are there other cases you think are important that we should be aware of?
Yeah, don't get me started. How long is this show?
You have all the time you want, my friend.
It's 8 hours, right? Well, I mean, let me mention one just because I think that in some ways it also represents the shape of things to come. Okay. For many years, I was trying to find the right way to challenge the secret terrorism watch list called the no-fly list. And people are familiar more or less with how the no-fly list operates. The government maintains a secret list of people who literally are not allowed to fly within the U.S. or over U.S. airspace. It's a secret list, as I said. They don't send you a letter saying you're on this list. And we don't actually want them to send that letter, right? If they have a legitimate reason for wanting to, you know, even arrest somebody, they don't have to tip them off. The problem with it is that until we filed a lawsuit some years ago, it operated with zero due process. So you would show up at the airport, a U.S. citizen. Many of our plaintiffs in our lawsuit were military veterans. You would be denied boarding. You would be taken to a room and usually asked questions by a bunch of government agents, including FBI agents. And then you would be sent home and not allowed to fly. They wouldn't present any evidence against you. And if you wanted to complain, you were able to fill out a so-called redress form with the TSA. And everybody got the same answer. We have reviewed your case. If any action should have been taken, we've taken it. Now, the problem is you didn't even know what the basis was for your being on the list. So you don't know how to object. You don't know if it's error or you don't know if it's innuendo. And that's basically the end of the process. No opportunity for you to confront evidence, no opportunity for you to be represented.
Have there ever been successful cases where people have been able to get off the list?
Well, there have been cases because, you know, obviously, while the government's official position was and still is that they will not confirm or deny whether anybody is on the list, that's a farcical position when someone has just been denied boarding in front of
you know, if you're on the list,
you know, and everyone else knows because you haven't been allowed to get on. And so
can I play the devil's advocate a little bit?
Please.
Because isn't flying a privilege, not a right?
Well, let me give you some examples from our lawsuit. We had U.S. citizens, again, some military veterans, who were visiting relatives overseas, and because they were on the no-fly list, they were not able to get back into the country. So they were effectively put into exile in Egypt or in Yemen, and now if they could make their way to Canada or Mexico, they could walk across the border because right. The government can't keep citizens out. But they had no way of getting back.
There is a higher standard. It's more than just a privilege.
There is, but even if something is not independently a right, so there is no constitutional right to fly by plane. Nonetheless, you have a right to some process when the government is going to take this away from you. So to take away your ability to be at the events of loved ones, take away your ability to earn a livelihood in some cases. So there has to be – the government can't have complete unfettered discretion to make these decisions. What actually the process is something that will still be worked out. But this was, again, a lawsuit that we filed on behalf of about a dozen U.S. citizens who had been denied boarding multiple times. And finally, we were able to get a federal court to say that it, you know, is ludicrous for the government to refuse to acknowledge that those people are on the no-fly list.
Yeah.
And there has to be some place for them to go, some kind of hearing where they can see some version of the government's case against them and be able to say either I did not do that or I'm not that person.
That is a fundamental constitutional right to face your accuser and defend yourself.
That's the reason why I say this may be a harbinger of things to come. is that one of the things that big data has allowed governments and corporations to do is to make important decisions about us in secret, using proprietary algorithms that are not transparent and that we'll never see. And so you could think about something like government watch lists as your citizen score. Already, some of us get to go through some lines at airports and others go through other lines. And no doubt there's an automated aspect of the decision making for who gets which privilege. And you can imagine a world in which those kinds of different lines are expanded and extended into all other walks of life and not just airports. And anybody who's ever had trouble with a credit score, you know, understands the frustration of having supercomputers make judgments about you that may be wrong, and how hard it can be for you to correct those. And I do think that we are moving towards a world in which there will be many more decisions made about us and for us that have real world consequences, that are made in secret, that are automated, without any kind of clear due process rules for us to push back against. And so we have to just remember principles of basic fairness, even as we want the benefits that those that big data and supercomputers can provide.
It's interesting. It strikes me that technology has really shifted the balance here.
Well, it has, and that's exactly right. That you see these institutions having more and more power. You know, there is an asymmetric element in the other direction as well, and that's represented by people like Edward Snowden. You know, Daniel Ellsberg had to, you know, enlist his teenage children in a safe house to help him Xerox thousands of pages over a period of days. Whereas you can now press a button and have CD-ROMs and thumb drives full of the government's precious secrets and change the world with that kind of information. So I think that technology has sort of upended these power dynamics, but not in ways that are always predictable.
You know, it's interesting because one of the reasons I started doing this and started talking about technology was to, in effect, redress the imbalance. That it's, I always felt that it was very important for all of us to understand how to use technology, at least in self-defense, at the very least in self-defense, because it will be used against you. So you need to understand it so that you can protect yourself. And it's very clear that we have to, if I'm going to come away with one thing from our conversation today, it's that this is an ongoing battle and it will not end. Do not say, oh, we're going to win down the road or we're going to lose down the road. This is how it's meant to be. This is the battle to preserve our republic, and we all need to engage in it. And Ben, I'm so glad that you are there at the ACLU and that you and all the others at the ACLU do fight that fight, because it's a very, very important fight.
Well, thanks so much for giving me time to have this extended conversation and to allow me to go beyond usual media sound bites and drill a little deeper on some of these issues and some of these cases.
Well, good. And maybe we can do it again, because I think that, as you said, this is an 8-hour conversation. We only get one. Ben Wiesner is director of the ACLU Speech Technology and Privacy Project and Edward Snowden's legal counsel. And as you can see, there's a lot more to talk about. But if anything, I think we should all come away with this notion that, and I think it's unfortunate that geeks often throw up their hands and say, you know, it's intractable, it's impossible, I'm not going to get involved because there's no good solution. And I think it's really important that we understand that those of us who do understand these issues do need to get involved, do need to participate, and do need to make sure that our elected representatives understand what's at stake here, because a lot is at stake. Thank you so much, Ben, for your time.
Thanks a lot, Leo.
Appreciate it. And don't forget to vote November 8th, everybody. We do triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. Actually, those of you who are not United States citizens, you don't have to vote. I forget that we're global. You can vote in your country's elections, though. And this is a battle that is raging all over the world. It's not unique to the United States. So let's all do the best we can as geeks here. I hope you'll stop by next Monday and every Monday. But if you can't, we make on-demand versions of all of our shows available, audio and video. You can get this particular show and all the Triangulation episodes at twit.tv/TRI. But you can also subscribe and get it because it's a podcast. That means you can go to iTunes or Stitcher or Slacker or Google Music or anywhere you get your podcasts. And what I'm thrilled to say is increasingly that's everywhere. Make sure you subscribe, though, because this is one show you really don't want to miss an episode. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.